You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, our special guest is Ari Nayar, former head of the American Civil Liberties Union, where he guided some of the organization's most defining cases.
He's also the author of Defending My Enemy, Skokie, and the Legacy of Free Speech in America, a seminal account of one of the ACLU's most controversial and consequential battles.
We'll also speak with attorney Mara Vahaden Hilliard about the National Guards patrolling the streets of Washington, D.C.
We'll hear how the district has a slightly different legal structure from other cities and what the occupation means for the rest of the nation. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. At the heart of Trump's blizzard of chaotic, cruel, and corrupt attacks on our democracy is one of the most turbulent, disruptive, and consequential assaults on freedom of speech in American history. Trump and his obedient underlings have enlisted the full force of the federal government's overwhelming criminal, civil, administrative, immigration, and national security apparatus to illegally crush protest, dissent, and free speech. On an unprecedented scale, directly and indirectly, Trump is violating the First Amendment rights of every person in the United States to express and receive information and ideas free of government censorship. He's going after the Voice of America, the Smithsonian Museum, the Associated Press, NPR, PBS, ABC, CBS, the Library of Congress, local public libraries, foreign and domestic students, immigrants, colleges and universities, elected officials, law firms and judges. And by silencing all of these voices, he is denying the constitutional right of every American to hear what those voices have to say. The United States is in a constitutional crisis. It's imperative that we vigorously defend our rights. The reissuance of the seminal book, Defending My Enemy, Skokie and the Legacy of Free Speech in America, by Arye Nayar, could not have come at a better time to remind us of the importance of defending the essential freedom upon which all others depend, freedom of speech. Defending My Enemy was originally published in 1979. At that time, Nayar was the national executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, which agreed to represent the Nazis in the Skokie controversy. Defending My Enemy was a brave book when it was originally published, and almost 50 years later, it remains an indispensable guide to help us navigate today's convulsive debates over free speech on American campuses and throughout our society. This edition of Defending My Enemy is enhanced by a new foreword by Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, a new foreword by Nadine Strausen, president of the ACLU from 1991 to 2008, and an extensive new chapter by Nayar himself offering his views on the contemporary challenges facing free speech in America. In addition to previously serving as executive director of the ACLU, Nayar co-founded Human Rights Watch and is president emeritus of the Open Society Foundations, where he remains active in their work. He has written 7 books and over 300 articles and op-eds on civil and human rights. It's our distinct pleasure to have Arye Nayar with us today on Law and Disorder. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Very glad to be with you.
Well, thank you. And let's get right into it. The Skokie case has become emblematic of a persistent dilemma. Why should the First Amendment protect people and groups who spew hateful speech and who would deny the right to free speech to the rest of us if they ever came to power? As a child, you escaped Nazi Germany and lost many of your family in the Holocaust. Please remind our listeners about the key facts in the Skokie case and why, as a Jew, you decided to defend the right of American Nazis to march in the predominantly Jewish village of Skokie, Illinois.
The Nazis who wanted to march in Skokie, Illinois, were a small group who had tried to demonstrate in a park in Chicago that divided a black neighborhood from a neighborhood that was predominantly East European in provenance. And they were restricted from doing so by a federal court. While they were restricted, they tried to remain active, and they notified a number of communities around Chicago that they would march in those communities. Most of the communities ignored them. Skokie responded, in effect, saying, "Don't you dare come here." And Skokie passed a series of ordinances to make it impossible for the Nazis to march in Skokie. And because of that, the ACLU decided to represent the Nazis, to uphold the principle that any group expressing any point of view can exercise free speech in the United States. The principle at stake is simply that government officials, whether it's Donald Trump or anyone else, may not decide who can speak and who may not speak on the basis of the views they hold. And we thought it was essential to uphold that principle.
Aria, how did the courts ultimately resolve the legal and constitutional issues in the Skokie case?
There were cases in both the state courts in Illinois, going up to the Illinois Supreme Court, and in the federal courts, going up to the United States Supreme Court. And the courts were unanimous in upholding free speech. So the courts made it possible for the Nazis to march. Ultimately, of course, the Nazis did not march in Skokie. There would have been a small handful of them. There would have been a very large crowd opposed to them. They would have looked ridiculous. And so they didn't exercise the right that we succeeded in upholding in the courts. I was a Jew born in Nazi Germany in 1937. My parents and I were able to escape Germany immediately before the outbreak of World War II in Europe. It was essential to us that we should be able to call out to others to help us in a time of great need. It is always essential for those who suffer from persecution to be able to speak out, to enlist others to help them, and thereby to save themselves. And I think minorities who suffer from persecution have always been those who depend most on the right to free speech and can survive only in circumstances where freedom of speech is protected for all.
Arye, the ACLU received a lot of flack in that period. Historians say that you lost members and contributions. For you as the leader of the organization, what was that period like? And what's been the legacy of the Skokie case in American law? Do you believe it's had an impact in the public understanding of why we defend controversial and offensive free speech that we hate?
It was difficult for us to deal with the loss of members and the loss of finances because of the Skokie case. Although I should point out that that was a difficulty that we suffered for a limited period and that after a while, we were able to recruit a much larger number of members. And I think over time, our willingness to stand up for principle was actually beneficial for the ACLU from an organizational standpoint. During the 15 months that the Skokie case was underway in the courts, I participated in a great many public fora on the case. I spoke at synagogues, at churches, and at universities about the Skokie case. In the early part of that period, my audiences were generally opposed to the views that I was expressing. It seemed to me that as time went on, more and more of my audiences were favorable to the stand on free speech I was expressing. I think that's the case because many people participated in debates with family members, with friends, with neighbors, with acquaintances about the Skokie case. And I think that the free speech position got stronger and stronger as those debates took place. More and more people persuaded themselves and persuaded each other that it was important to protect freedom of speech. I think that was also true in the courts. I can't prove that, but it seemed to me that in the wake of the Skokie case, in general, the courts were more protective of freedom of speech than they had been up to that point. And I don't know whether that's still the case today. I hope so. I hope it results in court decisions that deal with the matters that you pointed out in your introduction.
Aria, why did you decide to release the book Defending My Enemy at this particular time in American history? And also, why did you decide to include a new foreword by Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton and a new afterword by Nadine Strossen?
Well, I thought that there were many challenges to freedom of speech today and that the Skokie case had had a valuable impact on thinking about freedom of speech at the time it took place, and I hoped for some kind of repetition today. As far as Eleanor Holmes Norton is concerned, she was my colleague at the American Civil Liberties Union, and she and I joined in dealing with some significant matters involving freedom of speech. At one point, I went to Eleanor, a black woman, and asked her to defend Governor George Wallace's right to use Shea Stadium for a political rally in New York State. And Eleanor didn't hesitate for a moment. She said, sure. And she quickly rose to Wallace's defense. The willingness of a black woman in the late 1960s to do something like that had a very important impact, and she played an important role in a number of crucial freedom of speech cases. Nadine Strossen became president of the ACLU after my period as executive director, but she has become a leading voice for freedom of speech and for the values that I tried to uphold in the Skokie case. And therefore, it was a great honor to me that she agreed to participate in the publication of the book by adding an afterword to the book.
In the reissued edition of your book, you added a new chapter yourself, which you completed in January of this year. Among other current issues, you condemn the efforts of the Trump administration to deport foreign students such as Mahmoud Khalil for organizing pro-Palestinian protests, and the Trump efforts to cancel federal funding in universities such as Columbia for allegedly failing to protect students from anti-Semitism. What concerns do you have today that the definition of anti-Semitism is being stretched far beyond illegal discrimination of Jews for being Jews to encompass constitutionally protected criticism of Israel and Israel's war in Gaza?
Well, I think it's a great mistake to conflate anti-Semitism with criticism of the policies of the government of Israel. I think Israel has to be dealt with as a state in the same manner that one deals with any other state in the world, simply seeing it as the actions of the Jewish people is harmful to the state of Israel, and I believe it is harmful to Jewish people who may have different opinions about the public policies expressed by the state of Israel. I think anti-Semitism is bias against Jews for being Jews and discrimination against Jews for being Jews. I think criticism of the state of Israel is as appropriate as criticism of the United States, of Britain, of Russia, of France, or of any other country. I don't think it is helpful to Israel to be seen as not being a state in the same way that any other country is seen as a state.
Aria, in the book, Defending My Enemy, you write that as a member of a vulnerable community, you want, quote, restraints on power that prohibit those in power from interfering with my right to speak, my right to publish, or my right to gather with others who also feel threatened. Now, with many universities, law firms, politicians, and so many others sheepishly capitulating to what Donald Trump is doing, how can our listeners embrace your commitment to defending the right to speak, to publish, and to protest?
I think all of us are members of various associations or take part in public activities in various ways. And I think in that process, it is likely that all of us will at some point or another encounter situations in which there are issues involving freedom of speech. And I think in those circumstances, speaking out and being forthright about the right to speak is a very important thing. Even if one doesn't encounter those circumstances in one's own life, there are opportunities to take part in public affairs. There are opportunities to express one's views that everybody has. And I think one shouldn't neglect any opportunity to state one's commitment to values like freedom of speech.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Stephen Rohde. I'm joined today by my co-host, Heidi Boghossian, the author of a new book, Cyber Citizens, Saving Democracy with Digital Literacy. Today, we're joined by Ari Nayar, the author of the book, Defending My Enemy. Ari, what is your assessment today with such a long view? Almost 50 years since you wrote Defending My Enemy, years of experience at the ACLU, Open Society, Human Rights Watch. What's your assessment of freedom of speech and academic freedom in the United States today? And given that long experience, do you have any sense of how permanent any of the injuries to our constitutional rights that are being suffered right now will last? Or from your historical perspective, is this a period you anticipate we will come through?
I think that's an immensely important question. I think the current period is different from any other period that I experienced or any other period that I know about in American history. There have been certain times when there were sustained attacks on freedom of speech in the United States. Perhaps the worst period in American history was during the 2 years that the United States entered World War One, and in the couple of years immediately after World War One. During World War One, there were many people who opposed American entry into the war, and there were many people who opposed the draft. And there were an immense number of prosecutions under the Federal Espionage Act, enacted in 1917, and the amendments to the Espionage Act, known as the Sedition Act, enacted in 1918. One scholar calculated that there were about 2,000 prosecutions for freedom of speech in the United States during that period. And when Eugene Victor Debs, the leader of the Socialist Party, was convicted for relatively mild criticism of the government, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison, and the conviction was upheld unanimously by the U.S. Supreme Court. In the wake of the war, we had the Palmer raids, in which thousands of radicals were rounded up, and many of them were deported summarily from the United States. But in periods like that, and in periods like the Vietnam War period, or periods like the McCarthy period after World War II, the radicals who were under attack resisted. And over time, freedom of speech prevailed. Lawyers for the American Civil Liberties Union and for some others assisted or made it possible for them to prevail over a long period of time. The current situation is one in which establishment institutions like the major broadcast networks, major law firms, elite universities have been under attack on matters involving freedom of speech. And unfortunately, those elite institutions, for the most part, have succumbed. They have given in to the Trump administration. They have large amounts of money that is at stake, and I think that's the reason that they have given in to the Trump administration. But the crucial thing when there are attacks on freedom of speech is one needs to resist those attacks. One should do it through the courts, but one should do it also through public expression, through public education, through media criticism of the those who are suppressing freedom of speech. And there hasn't been the resistance by elite institutions that I would have anticipated. So I don't know how this is all going to work out, but I think we're in a very dangerous period today.
Would you just expand your last answer? You were close to it by talking about resistance, but that it is indispensable for public protests, the No King's Day, the marches, the large use of protest and dissent itself.
I think it's important not only that the institutions themselves should resist interference with their freedom of expression, but I think it's critical that the public at large should join in supporting those institutions that do resist and in helping to stigmatize those who go along with the Trump administration. I think participation in various public demonstrations is an important way to make clear that the American society as a whole rejects efforts to interfere with freedom of speech.
Arye, thank you so much for joining us here today on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I enjoyed taking part in the conversation. And thank you very much for the attention to the book. I'm very grateful to you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Soldiers in uniform are still patrolling the streets of Washington, D.C. They're not just on guard duty. They've been spotted picking up trash, spreading mulch, and even posing with tourists. And now their mission has been extended indefinitely. The Army has ordered nearly 1,000 National Guard members to remain on active duty through November 30th, 2025. Donald Trump could end it sooner or push it even further. But for now, the deployment is open-ended. Another 1,300 Guard troops from states like Louisiana and Ohio are also staying through December. The official line is that they are tackling, quote, out-of-control crime. But many residents and local officials see something else, a military force filling civic space, performing chores that look more like public relations rather than public safety. Ward 1 Commissioner Peter Wood called the outreach, quote, uncomfortable and concerning, stressing that soldiers patrolling civilian neighborhoods creates more fear than comfort. Clearly, this isn't just about crime or cleanup crews. It's about what kind of country we want to be when soldiers become part of daily civic life. Joining us to talk about the stakes for democracy is civil liberties attorney and activist Mara Verheyden-Hilliard. She's the executive director of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund based in Washington, D.C. Mara, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Mara, you've said recently that, quote, Donald Trump has created the fiction of an emergency to turn the nation's capital into a prototype of a police state. Can you explain what you mean by that and why you see D.C. as a model application for militarized rule?
The administration took two major steps in terms of deploying and federalizing military and law enforcement in the District of Columbia. The Trump administration deployed the National Guard because in Washington, D.C., the nature of the District of Columbia, really as a colony, means that the President of the United States is in charge of the National Guard the way that in other states the governor is in charge of the National Guard. So he had a unique capacity and authority to deploy National Guard into Washington, D.C. Under the Home Rule Act in the District of Columbia, also an element of being a colony, in essence, without full representation or statehood, the administration invoked Section 740, which allows a federalization or use of District of Columbia Police for federal needs or federal purposes. So because the District of Columbia has a unique status and lesser status, it created this opportunity for the administration to use it as a testing ground for deployment of military and federalization of police. And that's why we believe that this has now become the prototype and the testing ground for a police state.
Mara, you've also asserted that the federal takeover of the District of Columbia Police Department is an unlawful abuse of federal authority. What places this action outside the scope of Section 740 of the Home Rule Act you mentioned, or the rules governing National Guard deployment?
The administration's actions were also coupled with the surge of federal law enforcement into the streets of the District of Columbia. And that began deploying federal law enforcement into the streets of District of Columbia outside even of the invocation of Title 32 or Section 740 by surging district streets with federal police agencies. And this began several days before the invocation of the other authorities. And we believe in total this is an unlawful abuse of federal authority, because what the administration is doing is it's using federal military for policing, for law enforcement policing, which it is not allowed to do, and which they said they were doing it to, quote, fight crime. And also because their attempt initially with the Home Rule Act was to say that they were taking over the district's police and that they were going to install their own sort of substitute police chief, which was challenged and which they have stepped back from. But at every step of the way, the administration is really trying to use D.C. and abuse the residents of the District of Columbia to impose its own sort of testing out of a martial law type of police state. What they're trying to do is make all of us used to the idea of having military on the streets of American cities.
Mara, paint a more detailed picture for us. I can't begin to imagine what this looks like. What are the optics of having National Guard presence, and what is the impact that you're seeing on residents and also visitors, both in daily life and in people's sense of normalcy and freedom?
When they issued all these announcements, all of the King's Court around the Trump administration jumped to the microphone to talk about how terrible the District of Columbia is and how they so badly wish they could go to the Smithsonian Museums, but they just can't because they're too scared, but now it'll all be better. And, you know, it's an absurd portrait of this city. The District of Columbia is a vibrant, thriving city. It's got lovely areas where, you know, people live and raise their children. The tourists come to D.C. year after year after year and go see the Free Smithsonians and the zoo and the institutions, the federal institutions of government, and enjoy the district. And so this description of it as just like this apocalyptic wasteland is, of course, a complete lie. And this is all by people who, like, don't know anything about the district, and to the extent they see it outside like the tinted windows of their chauffeured cars and or motorcades. So, you know, to start with, they just created a completely false and lying portrait of the district. Well, what we have now is areas of the district where there are National Guards persons who, interestingly enough, have mainly been placed on the National Mall around Union Station in some metro areas, almost more as photo opportunity than anything else. And of course, many of those National Guards persons would much rather be home with their families than being sent on these lengthy deployments into the District of Columbia to stand around. But the reality of that is that you have this presence, this sort of constant presence of armed military and military gear when you're walking around D.C., when you look up. You know, it's a very oppressive presence. It's the kind of thing that, you know, we all imagine or are told as children only happens in authoritarian countries. And yet that is what we have here. But the palpable experience day in and day out that is very significant is this flood of federal law enforcement personnel, Homeland Security personnel, FBI, Moore Park Police, who are working hand in hand with the District of Columbia Police Department in these extreme types of repressive actions against the residents of the district. That is where we are all feeling the activity, these checkpoints that have been set up, them simply grabbing food delivery workers off of their motorized bikes. This is like this constant presence marching through district parks and spaces, questioning people, showing up outside buildings, really terrorizing the community and the district. That's what we're really feeling.
So to follow up on that, why is this deployment, why does it keep getting extended? I think I know the answer. It's not about public safety. Is it about optics? And I think you've said normalizing the presence and the control. Would you expand on that?
Well, the interesting dynamic here which, you know, bears noting, has to do with the mayor of the District of Columbia and even the district's attorney general, and the general response to this, which is there has been objection to the National Guard and some objection to the intended efforts to put in a substitute police chief from the attorney general's office, but not an objection to this violent policing, this extreme racial profiling, these seizures of persons without reasonable suspicion, because the DC police are working hand in hand, and it's been endorsed by the mayor, who has thanked President Trump, the Democratic mayor of the District of Columbia, who is happily working in saying that she's working in support and in partnership with the federal deployment of law enforcement throughout the streets of DC, who is showing no opposition, who is not standing up for the residents of the District of Columbia. And the people around her have tried to say, oh, this is like some clever game, because by capitulating to the Trump administration and beyond capitulating, actually supporting, endorsing, and allowing this this to grow, that somehow she's holding back the extreme repression. And of course, that's a complete absurdity. I mean, at this point, it's like the Vichy mayor of the District of Columbia. And the opposition language very frequently is like saying that they don't want the National Guard, they don't want overreach into the affairs of the District of Columbia or home rule or autonomy. And of course, that's valid. But they don't oppose the repressive policing by even, of course, their own police department, which they routinely defend and defend in court and defend in all ways, or their federal partners who are now coming in and ratcheting up this extreme stop and seizure campaign.
So, Mara, in this giant, really public relations ploy, do you see any residents of the area, their trust in government being eroded, or a lot of Americans now fall for the illusion of increasing safety and praising the government for getting involved? But what's happening in terms of public opinion in D.C.?
Well, the District of Columbia actually had a decrease in crime, which is just aligned with national trends generally. And where there are real issues of problems with youth activity, youth criminal activity, or other types of criminal activity, or issues involving severe mental health issues and unhoused persons, you know, these are problems that need real solutions. These aren't problems that just get policed away. These are problems that have to be addressed with meeting the needs of people on the ground. There are communities that actually, you know, would welcome efforts to address crime in their community, but not with this, because this isn't really addressing any meaningful or substantive issues. And the residents of the District of Columbia, those in Black and Brown communities in D.C. who have lived under racist, oppressive policing consistently and forever, it's not a new thing, but we have a level of overdrive now and a widespread level, as I said, of this federal policing working with DC police, really terrorizing, stomping around the district, questioning people, frightening people, seizing people. And the residents of the district are opposed to it. There is widespread opposition here. And what has come out is really this amazing type of collectivity and support for neighbors and strangers that people don't even know. So that there are incidents over and over again where federal law enforcement and Homeland Security are suddenly questioning people or coming up to people and terrifying people. And other people who feel that they're in a greater capacity to intervene or respond are coming up in defense of their neighbors. There are so many volunteers on the streets who are coming to stop, to question, to intervene, to tell people, know your rights, to tell people you don't have to answer the questions, to tell people, like, ask, am I being detained or am I free to go? There are many, many people who are coming out every time there is another checkpoint or another visible deployment to be monitoring, to be recording, and to be reporting back. So there is this really immediate collectivity of people that sprung into action that is incredibly powerful. And people are protesting, they're organizing. There was a large protest this past weekend in opposition to the federal militarization of DC and the authoritarian takeover. So there is strong and growing and powerful opposition.
Mara, tell us more about the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund and the efforts you've been making even before this occupation to try to reform the kinds of assaults on personal liberties that are occurring in D.C.
The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund is a nonprofit civil rights organization that works very closely in defensive movements for justice and liberation movements across the United States. And we have for 30 years litigated here in Washington, D.C., where we're headquartered, as well as around the country. We have a West Coast office in Oakland as well, and we've litigated in many locations, including where, you know, wherever there are major events, struggles, protests, uprisings. In Washington, D.C., we have litigated major cases against the District of Columbia Police Department, as well as against the federal government and federal police agencies, defending and advancing First Amendment rights and Fourth Amendment rights. And the outcome of our lawsuits has included major changes in how police are allowed to respond to demonstrations, both local police as well as federal policing authorities. And even in the context of what we're dealing with right now in the occupation and deployment of police and checkpoints, we brought the litigation years ago challenging the deployment of a what was called a neighborhood safety zone checkpoint operation program in D.C., which we had struck down successfully going up to the D.C. Circuit with a three-judge panel ruling that it was unconstitutional. So we look at the cases based on the real-life experiences that are happening and how can we bring our litigation to make space for people to be able to speak out and to fight for justice, and how do we bring our litigation to stop aggressive, authoritarian, governmental abuse and discriminatory conduct against the people of the United States.
Mara, on a slightly different note, I've read that officials have said that longer orders help stabilize the pay and the benefits for National Guard members. Is that part also of their campaign to make this look like a good effort on behalf of government and law enforcement?
Well, certainly that came out recently as an element in their thinking, the idea that like they wanted to meet these 30-day marks because they wanted to do it for personnel reasons. But I doubt that when it comes to the top officials in the Trump administration, they care much about anything other than the power grab of feeling like you can deploy federal troops to American cities. I mean, you have Donald Trump announcing that he's going to war against American cities, including Chicago. The level of sort of almost extreme hatred for the people of the United States, this idea that they are to be subjects under the control of a president almost acting almost like a king in a country that has rejected kings, says a great deal. And it's playing with the idea that they have the authority, and so they should use all authority to subdue all subjects. And while they are aggressively going after hardworking people in the United States who are immigrants and viciously grabbing and disappearing people and taking away neighbors and coworkers and families, they are also sort of loosening up and exercising this aggressive use of federal law enforcement and military to create the process for suppression on many levels, including suppression of dissent and suppression of the people of the United States who are growing in magnitude of resistance against the government attacks on their neighbors, their co-workers, their family members, and other mechanisms of repression. So we know that these deployments are not to be taken lightly. And the idea of calling up other National Guards or getting other governors to send them into the district because they can, again, because of the nature of the unusual structure of the district. But they obviously want to be able to do this across the country. They want to be able to march in authority to subdue all the people in the United States who are not going to accept being under authoritarian rule. And it is crucial that people are able to organize, that they can find other groups and people that they want to work with and that they can work with collectively, and that organizations like ours, but many other organizations, are coming together and creating a legal fight back and engaging in a legal fight back, because none of us are going to tolerate this attempt to override fundamental democratic principles.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Heidi Boghossian with my co-host Stephen Rohde, and we're speaking with Mara Verheyden-Hilliard, a civil liberties attorney from Washington, D.C.
Mara, this kind of indefinite deployment could set a dangerous precedent for other cities, even though D.C. has its own special legal status. So what are your concerns about this expanding to Chicago, for example?
The Trump administration, President Trump himself, threatened to, you know, as he was threatening to go to war against Chicago and other American cities, that really making it sound he was sending the military to invade Chicago. He backed off of that in recent days, but they are carrying out what they're calling the Midway Blitz, which is, again, using federal law enforcement in this aggressive attack on community members in Chicago, something that they have done in other locations all around the country, where they're raiding workers, you know, at their plants. They're just taking people away. It's really just this vicious attack on working people in the United States. So in Chicago, in Illinois, unlike the district, the governor there is not calling out the National Guard. And so for the federal government to try and send military or National Guard over the objections of the governor, which is what they did in Los Angeles, has met a very significant setback, at least legally, for the Trump administration, because the litigation in Los Angeles resulted in a ruling saying that the federalization of the National Guard trumps sending out National Guard without the governor's doing it or the governor's request was a violation, including of the Posse Comitatus Act, because the federal government cannot use federal military authority for law enforcement purposes. And that's what the administration said that it was doing. Now, under the Insurrection Act, that's an exception to the Posse Comitatus Act, but even then, it can't be invoked just automatically. There has to be a request by state or local officials unless the federal government is able to demonstrate that they're unable or unwilling to act. So there are restrictions on the use of domestic deployment of military.
Mara, our time is running out, but how can our listeners follow the work of the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund?
People can follow us by going to our social media accounts at the PCJF. So that's @thePCJF. And by coming to justiceonline.org. That's justiceonline.org, our website, where you can learn more in depth about our cases, about what we're doing, what we're fighting, where you can get Know Your Rights information, including what to do when federal law enforcement or the FBI comes to your door. So justiceonline.org will also allow you to sign up for breaking alerts from us. So those would be the best ways to connect, and we urge people to connect with us.
Mara, once again, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to staying in touch about future developments.
Thank you for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at
lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get an update on the Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani's New York City mayoral campaign.
Our guest, John Tarleton, is editor-in-chief of the Independent newspaper in New York City. He gives us a political science crash course on how close Mamdani could be to winning the election. We then talk with animal rights lawyer Matthew Strugar about the fundamentals of animal rights law.
Attorney Matthew Strugar sets up several prominent current cases to illustrate the effectiveness of animal rights law.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The mayoralty campaign of Zohran Mamdani in New York City is the most hopeful development on the left in America today. Mamdani is a charismatic 33-year-old Uganda-born ex-state legislator and a wholehearted supporter and member of the Democratic Socialists of America. He is challenging former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who was recently forced to resign in disgrace after being credibly accused by 13 women of sexual harassment. Cuomo represents the establishment, the real estate, financial, and big tech interests in America's largest city. He has the support of major media and even Donald Trump. Meanwhile, none of the leading Democratic Party figures in New York, except Governor Hochul, support Mamdani. Mamdani won the primary by a landslide. His support comes mostly from the young, black people, Asians, and a white working class in neighborhoods throughout New York City. During the primary campaign, 50,000 volunteers knocked on 1,500,000 doors with the message that their candidate will work to make their lives better. The major media in New York City have thrown their weight behind Cuomo, but New York City's grassroots newspaper, The Independent, has covered the Mamdani campaign consistently and extensively since its beginning. We speak today with John Tarleton, who is the co-founder and editor-in-chief of The Independent. It is a free monthly newspaper and website published in New York City since 2000. He's the co-host of The Independent News Hour on WBAI in New York City. John Tarleton, a hearty welcome to Law & Disorder Radio.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be back on the show.
John, Zohran Mamdani stunned the world in June when he defeated Andrew Cuomo to win the Democratic nomination for New York City mayor. What's the state of the race with Election Day now only 7 weeks away? And how's New York City's general election electorate different from the one that voted for Mamdani in the primaries?
Yeah, so Zohran Mamdani holds a comfortable lead in all the polls. He's polling at around 45%, and he's facing three more conservative opponents in this general election, and he's having to do it with significant parts of the Democratic establishment here in New York still refusing to endorse him and support his campaign, even though he's heavily favored to win in November. Now, those three opponents are Andrew Cuomo, the former governor he defeated in the primary, New York's mayor, Eric Adams, who dropped out of the primary, and then the Republican nominee, Curtis Sliwa, who's best known for leading the Guardian Angels vigilante group and also for being a conservative television commentator. Now, the reason Cuomo and Adams are still in the race is New York has some very peculiar rules that allow someone to essentially create their own almost fictitious party. And if they can pay people to go out and get enough petition signatures, they can be on the ballot. So Cuomo lost the Democratic primary by 13 points in that huge upset to Zoran. He's now running on something called the Fight and Deliver Party. Eric Adams, who was elected 4 years ago as mayor as a Democrat, is running on two ballot lines, one the safe and affordable ballot line and the other the End Anti-Semitism Now ballot line. It shows that even these political figures who have a long history in the Democratic Party ultimately see the party as just an instrument for advancing their own ambitions, and when it's no longer useful, they take this other route. Zoran is heavily favored, but I wouldn't say he's an absolute lock yet. I mean, running at around 45%. If these three conservative opponents, if two of them were to drop out and they could consolidate their vote, it would become a more competitive general election in November. So far, there's little sign that it will happen. Trump has been trying to get Eric Adams to drop out, and there's been a lot of talk that he would give Adams a position in his administration. There was talk he might be appointed as ambassador to Saudi Arabia or get an appointment in the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Adams has insisted he's staying in the race and has denounced Cuomo as a liar and a snake. So to Zoran's advantage, his opposition is deeply divided, and the Democratic Party establishment is slowly coming around to supporting him, or at least not opposing him. So this week, Governor Kathy Hochul finally endorsed Zoran. We also had the Speaker of the State Assembly, Carl Heasty, where Zoran has served the last 5 years. He endorsed Zoran just yesterday, and I think more importantly, said that he supported Zoran's plan for a millionaire's tax to pay for some of the key items in Zoran's platform, including establishing universal child care and fast and free buses across New York City. So that's significant. And a number of other lesser-known Democrats have, read the electoral map and decided to come on board with Zoran. Figures who are not supporting him so far include the two most prominent Democrats in Congress, Chuck Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate, and Hakeem Jeffries, congressman from Brooklyn, who leads the House Democrats. And both of these figures are very close with the billionaires in the party who are major donors, including figures aligned with AIPAC and groups like that that demand unconditional support for Israel. And of course, Zoran has espoused support for Palestinian liberation. So that's clearly been a fault line in all of this. The time is working against these establishment figures like Schumer and Jeffries. There's little sign that Cuomo is going to be able to rebound. But Cuomo's hanging out and hoping somehow things will shift in his direction. And part of what he's pinning his hopes on is that the general election electorate is more conservative than the primary electorate. Republicans will be able to vote in the general election, independents, who both left and right-leaning independents. But at the end of the day, here in New York, in presidential elections, Democratic candidates in the last three cycles have gotten between 70 and 80% of the vote pretty consistently. And the fact that Zoran's at just a little bit under 50% definitely shows it's part of the Democratic bloc, mostly older voters, a lot of older Jewish voters who are skittish about him, and maybe some of the older black voters who've supported Cuomo over the decades, are still kind of up for grabs. So overall, it's a good situation for Zoran, but it's really important that he win a decisive victory and certainly clear 50% so he can really sprint into his administration claiming a strong mandate for these ambitious programs he wants to advance.
Well, tell me, John, is Mamdani's general election campaign more or less the same, or is it different from his underdog primary campaign that so electrified the city?
Well, it's the same in that his stated platform, it remains exactly the same of the fast and free buses, rent freeze for rent-regulated tenants, setting up a government-run grocery stores, and things like that. He hasn't changed that one bit. what he has done, he's definitely put a lot more energy into trying to woo the Democratic establishment and get them on board with supporting him and trying to build out a broader coalition of support. And I think he's had some success with that. Obviously, there's key Democrats that are holding out, but I think he's gradually chipping away. You know, a lot of Democrats, I think, have resigned themselves to the fact that this guy is very likely the next mayor and they want to play ball with him. And I think he's also, I mean, his personality definitely helps him. He's got a very congenial personality. He's very intelligent. A lot of these figures that feel heard by him, he hasn't really changed his line, but he's just a very warm and engaging and intelligent person. So I think there are people that are wary of him, but feel like that he's not going to be so dogmatic that it's going to be impossible to work with him. And they've made their decision to try to play ball.
John Tarleton, many of New York's most prominent Democrats are still refusing to endorse Mamdani. Why do you think that is?